You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia, Simon Fraser University Campus Radio, streaming on the internet at www.cjsf.ca.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, your weekly report on Earth systems, human development, justice, and science. Today, Israel is an apartheid state, four American legal scholars say. We speak with one of them, and Israeli genocide, denying it while condoning it. American literary critic Sari MacDizzi talks about Western intellectual subterfuge and the erasure of the Palestinian people. This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Israel's treatment of Palestinians, which includes mass killing, arbitrary detention, torture, and the imposition of a legal regime that provides far less due process than that provided to Israelis living in the same territory, meets the legal definition of apartheid. So say four American human rights lawyers and scholars from Cornell Law School, Boston University School of Law, Columbia Law School, and Yale Jackson School of Global Affairs. The GPM spoke with one of them. Susan Akram is clinical professor and director of the International Human Rights Clinic at Boston University School of Law. We reached Susan Akram in Boston. Susan Akram, welcome to the Green Planet Monitor.
Thank you so much for having me, David.
And the next line in this paragraph, this is actually taken from your open letter to The Guardian. We are not the first to reach this conclusion. And indeed, you're not. And it's interesting, at the very start of your full report, there's a list of 32 reports that you consulted by international legal scholars and human rights experts who have opined since, I believe, 2007 must have been one of the earliest of those reports. 32 reports making the argument that Israel practices the crime of apartheid. And I'm sure there are more reports than that, and numerous statements and analyses and writings by a host of individual scholars and academics writing on their own. So my question to you is, how does your report add to this body of literature? And the key statement here is that you write in the report, the crime of apartheid also provides a legal framework for assessing Israel's actions since October 7th. And this is the first report to make this analysis. So what's the connection, Susan Akram, between what's been going on since October 7th, Israel's genocidal war on Gaza, and apartheid? What is it about this war that Israel's been waging, Israel-USA, that illuminates the apartheid question for you?
Yes, so you're right to point out how many reports have gone before ours. But in fact, it goes farther than that. You may remember Jimmy Carter's book, Peace, Not Apartheid. And that long preceded the more recent plethora of reports that have examined both the law on apartheid and the facts on the ground. What's particularly important about our timing is, first of all, reviewing the consensus that these reports come to about apartheid, that it is inescapable that what Israel has been doing for over 70 years, and certainly accelerating after 1967, is indisputably apartheid under the international legal definition, but also the trajectory of apartheid leading inexorably to genocide, which is what we are seeing unfolding in Gaza. And our report last year on genocide really complements the one that we have issued now this year on apartheid.
What is apartheid? How is the crime of apartheid defined? Because people, of course, they say Israel is a shining democracy. Arabs have full rights in Israel, which of course one can dispute. But the question is, what do we mean by Israel territorially? And then they say, of course, UK, it's not the same as what happened in South Africa. This is a libel. This is anti-Semitic to suggest that Israel commits the crime of apartheid. There's various things in there. You don't need to unpack all of it. But what is apartheid? And why would you come to the conclusion that Israel practices the crime?
Yes, so apartheid is defined as a crime against humanity in two conventions. The one we focus on primarily, but not exclusively, is the 1973 UN Convention on the Suppression and Punishment of Apartheid. The second definition is in the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. And between these two conventions, about 167 states have ratified one or both of these. So given the large number of states that have agreed to this definition and to criminalizing apartheid, we can conclude that the definition, the crime, is now customary international law, so that states like the United States and Israel, which are not parties to the apartheid convention, are still bound to the definition of the crime.
And you say it's jus cogens, it's customary. What does this mean?
Customary international law is derived from the notion that it is the practice of states under the belief that they are operating under force of law that becomes law in and of itself, even if the actual practice is not pursuant to a specific treaty binding the state. So that's what I meant by saying that because of the large number of countries that have ratified either the Rome Statute or the 1973 Apartheid Convention and make statements, practice as if this is law, that makes it customary law. Jus cogens is a rule that is binding on all states because it has arisen to the level of a practice against which any state is called to account if they do not abide by that particular practice or principle. So jus cogens is sort of the highest level of law, absolutely binding, and it creates certain obligations on other states. So such things as torture, enforced disappearances, of course, now apartheid, genocide, these are jus cogens rules, meaning no state can disobey or derogate from the rule.
They are peremptory norms.
Exactly. So let me go through briefly what the crime of apartheid is. It applies to certain inhuman acts for the purpose of establishing and maintaining domination by one racial group of people over another and systematically oppressing them. And it covers the denial to a member or members of a racial group the right to life and liberty of person, and then enumerates specific acts that are the crimes against humanity of apartheid. Murder by members of the racial group, infliction on a racial group of serious bodily or mental harm, infringement of freedom or dignity, subjecting them to torture, cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment, and then the deliberate imposition of a racial group of living conditions calculated to cause their physical destruction in whole or in part. Now, this definition can be conceptualized into three parts, which is what the International Court of Justice has helped us see in the 2024 advisory opinion. And it breaks it down into, one, you have to have the existence of an institutionalized regime of systematic racial oppression and discrimination. Two, the regime has to have been established with the intent of maintaining the domination of one racial group over another. And the third element is that the regime carries out these specific inhumane acts as an integral part of the regime. So the Rome Statute uses the language of institutionalized regime as well, in terms of the structure within which these sets of crimes are carried out, including the ones I mentioned: murder, extermination, deportation, torture, rape, persecution, and forcible transfer. So, as you mentioned, it's often claimed that apartheid was uniquely defined to cover the regime of South Africa. But during the drafting of the convention, Israeli practices towards Palestinians featured heavily and were discussed by the UN delegates, and language was introduced to cover the specific Israeli acts, like the denial of the right of return. We know from the drafting history that the Apartheid Convention was meant to be much broader and specifically was meant to cover what Israel was known to be doing vis-à-vis the Palestinians.
And indeed, many have argued, like John Dugard, a former UN Special Rapporteur on the human rights situation in Palestine, a Dutch South African jurist, that the practice of apartheid in Israel is worse than the practice was in South Africa.
Yes, in fact, many South Africans have made that comment, those who have visited, who lived through the apartheid regime there and have visited Israel-Palestine.
I mean, black
Yes.
South Africans were an integral, obviously an integral part of the South African economy. You did not have white, armed white vigilantes in South Africa backed by South African soldiers and police assaulting black South Africans and driving them from their townships and persecuting them, and as you do in Israel.
Right, and specifically the bifurcated regime that exists across the occupied territory, which is military law that applies to the Palestinians, whereas full civil Israeli law applies to the settlers. That did not manifest in South Africa.
And I've got here a quote from the 2014 concluding observations of the Human Rights Committee of the United Nations, which supervises the implementation of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. I always have thought that this is a marvelous quote. This is back from 2014 from the Human Rights Committee. The committee, while noting that relevant legislation is currently under review, is also concerned that the Jewish and non-Jewish populations are treated differently in several regards, and that the state parties, Israel's domestic legal framework, here we go, maintains a three-tiered system of laws, affording different civil status, rights, and legal protection for Jewish Israeli citizens, Palestinian citizens of Israel, and Palestinian residents of East Jerusalem. I mean, wow, that's like the very definition of apartheid.
Yes, and in fact, the Human Rights Committee, the Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, and the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination have all reviewed Israeli practices and concluded that they violate those treaties, the treaties of which they are authorized to monitor, because of the systematic regime of discrimination. They've addressed both the institutionalized regime of segregation established by Israel and describe the acts that I mentioned that are covered by the Apartheid Convention and the Rome Statute, crime of apartheid, even though they haven't necessarily named them apartheid. So we can just break those down a bit as we've done in our report. Under Israeli law and policy, group membership is an official category, and that's imposed and monitored by the state. It's not simply a voluntary identity. Israeli Jews are a group described and unified by law, sharing a particular preferential legal status wherever they reside, while Palestinian Arabs are a separate group defined by law and given inferior legal status. Now, I think it's important to point out that Israel is established and maintained as an ethno-national state. Its laws and policies are designed to privilege and ensure a Jewish majority. And it sets up a bifurcated system both within Israel, as the Human Rights Committee report points out, with regard to Palestinians and Jews, and also in the Palestinian territory occupied by Israel. Israeli law privileges Jewish inhabitants in citizenship, in residence, in land ownership, freedom of movement, education, and state resources that are withheld or minimally provided to Palestinians, but fully provided to Israeli Jews. And this is true within Israel, which maintains a parallel but unequal legislative system with superior rights for Jews and inferior rights for Palestinians.
For Palestinian citizens of Israel.
That's right. Within Israel, the law prevents Palestinians from full participation in political, economic, social, and cultural life.
I mean, they don't have national rights. Like people say, you know, geez, you know, Palestinians, Arabs with Israeli citizenship, they've got full rights, but they don't have national rights. They've got citizenship rights, but they don't have national rights. Only Jews have national rights.
That's exactly right.
Like the land belongs to the Jews and only the Jews.
Of course, absolutely. And that is done through legislation. So it's a legalized system of inferior and superior rights within Israel. But the starkest illustration of apartheid and what we focus the most on in our report is in the occupied territory, where over 500,000 Israeli settlers have full civil, political, economic, and social rights offered by the state to Jews, while Palestinians in the same area are governed by a brutal 57-year-old military occupation with over 1,000 military rules that affect all aspects of their lives. They're denied equal access to water, to their own land and properties, to freedom of movement, to legal status, to citizenship, to due process, or political participation in the regime that governs every aspect of their lives. And it's also important to remember that despite the so-called autonomy given to the Palestinian Authority in the Oslo Accords, Israel controls over 60% of the West Bank, and of course all of Gaza. And still today, even in the PA area, Area A, controls ingress, egress, and the ability of Palestinians to move in and out of their own areas.
I mean, it seems to me one of the, like, and Virginia Tilley has argued a lot about this, about the importance of examining the situation through a territorial lens, a territoriality lens. And I've entered Israel across the Allenby Bridge, across the Jordan River on multiple occasions. Is the most interesting way to enter Israel. Forget about flying into Ben Gurion. Just come in from Amman and cross over the King Hussein Bridge. And as soon as you cross over the Jordan River, you're in Israel. You pass through Israeli customs and immigration. You get an Israeli little immigration ticket, and you're in Israel. You pass through all the various tiers. And so for sure you're in the West Bank, quote unquote. You're in the Jordan Valley, but you are, it is as Israel as Tel Aviv and Haifa are. And in this whole territory, this is why people say, oh, Israel is democratic, but they're talking about just within the Green Line, which is fictitious. But Israel, quote unquote, really is all those territories west of the Jordan River. And you got 14 million people there, and half of them have national rights and half of them don't. And a little over a third of them have no rights at all, like 5 million Palestinians in the West Bank and, of course, in Gaza. And they're living under permanent military rule.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And in fact, if a Palestinian is not on the 1967 population registry, either, you know, as a resident of the West Bank or East Jerusalem or Gaza, they can't enter. So their family members can't enter. And of course, there's a whole series, separate series of laws in Jerusalem for Jerusalemite Palestinians that are even worse, the Center of Life Law, which states that if a Palestinian leaves the area to work, to study, whatever, and is out for too long a time, according to Israel, their center of life is no longer Jerusalem, and therefore they're not permitted to return. So the series of laws that deeply discriminate against Palestinians on both sides of the Green Line is just manifested differently. But it is Israel in complete control of the entire area. And of course, this has become clearer now with the latest Netanyahu, Ben-Gvir, and Smotrich governments. and the 2018 nation state law, Israel nation state law, that this is a land for Jews and not for anyone else.
Now, if you were to ask Mark Carney in Canada, Mark, does Israel practice the crime of apartheid? I think he probably wouldn't answer the question. He'd skirt it. Or if you ask David Lammy in the UK, does Israel practice apartheid? He wouldn't answer the question. Or Emmanuel Macron, who is probably the most enlightened of all of them and the most likely to push for Israel to truly be held accountable, although I won't hold my breath, but they won't admit that Israel practices the crime of apartheid. And you won't read about this in the media. There are no throwaway lines, no formulaic sentences that The Guardian slips into its stories about how Israel is widely considered to be an apartheid state, or, the Toronto Star or the Globe and Mail. It's not in the mass media. It's not acknowledged. So I guess my question is, 32, now 33 reports on Israeli apartheid. It's obvious that Israel practices the crime of apartheid, but the powers that be won't talk about it. And they certainly won't hold Israel accountable.
Of course. Well, just as there are consequences that flow from admitting that Israel is committing genocide, there are consequences for states from admitting that they are participating or in any way countenancing the crime of apartheid. Individuals and state representatives are criminally responsible if they commit, participate in, incite, or conspire to commit acts of apartheid, or if they abet, cooperate, or encourage the commission of the crime of apartheid. That's why members of government that are enabling Israel's apartheid actions will never name the crime. Unless, there's massive continuation of this public outcry and these politicians are thrown out and then prosecuted. The impunity is going to continue as long as the powerful states continue to support what Israel is doing. It's as simple as that.
And this was an important idea that came out at the Gaza Tribunal in Sarajevo at the end of May, which you attended. And various people said there's a naming problem, that the crime has to be named, and it's not named. And by not naming the crime, you confer impunity. That the first way to confer impunity is to simply deny that the crime is existing and just don't talk about it.
Of course, of course. And for people who are talking about it, it's risky. I know you've been following the students and faculty who have been speaking out against the Israeli crimes, who have been arrested, some criminally charged, some detained, some deported from here in the United States if they're non-US citizens, people who have lost jobs. Our students on our campuses worry about lost job opportunities, lost jobs, as well as facing disciplinary proceedings by campus administrators for protesting against Israeli actions and for Palestinian rights. So it's risky for those who speak out, as well as those who are on the front lines, like, Greta Thunberg, putting her life on the line with a flotilla of humanitarian aid to Gaza.
And I must confess, I went into the Canary Mission site a few hours ago, and I see that you're on Canary Mission. There's a great photo of you, Susan. You look great. I've always been a little bit peeved that I'm not on Canary Mission, and it's even occurred to me that I should contact them and insist that they list me, but I have not done it yet. But is this hazardous? Have you faced kickback or blowback or?
Of course, I've been doing this for so long and I've received all kinds of threats and harassment. And Canary Mission, by the way, is not the only of these targeted li targeting lists that I'm on. I'm on at least two others that I know about. But we're not human rights lawyers to be performatory. We're human rights lawyers when it really counts. And that is, if we don't speak up when the greatest crimes on earth are being committed, we're not worth the label of being human rights lawyers or advocates. So this is the time when our experience and our expertise is the most critical to bring to bear to the dialogue. And so, that's what I and my colleagues are trying to do.
What obligation do universities have under the Convention on the Protection of Human Rights Defenders? That's not the correct title for this instrument, but what obligations do universities actually have?
Well, of course, protecting freedom of speech is number one. And protecting the individuals who study or teach or work at their institutions, protecting their right to freedom of speech, to freedom of expression, to freedom of organization, to ensure that they are not subjected wrongly to disciplinary or criminal activities, to defend them. When the state goes too far and infringes on constitutional rights and international human rights of human rights defenders. And also, our institutions have the same obligations as states under conventions like the Genocide Convention and Apartheid Convention, not to be complicit in continuing inciting and supporting these crimes. So one of the big reasons we have published this report at this time is to call on our institutions to do what they are required to do under US constitutional law and under international human rights law.
And are you, as a group of writers and authors and your colleagues, actually speaking with universities and sitting down with them and talking about this report and what their obligations are under the Anti-Apartheid Convention and the Genocide Convention?
Well, we are actually mobilizing with other faculty in making demands of our universities. Yes, we have lots and lots of networks that we're involved in. We alone, our voices alone, we're a small group of human rights clinics that have come together since actually before October 7th, but we've accelerated our work on since October 7th. To hold our institutions to account, but our voices alone are not enough. So we have joined on each of our campuses, we've joined our various faculty groups that are demanding that our universities do the right thing.
And we're coming up to the 19th of September, 2025, which is the deadline that the UN General Assembly set out in its Resolution 1024 last September. Yeah, this was issued
Soon after the
18th
2024 advisory opinion, that's right.
of September 2024. So the 19th of September 2025, this coming up, the UN General Assembly is demanding that Israel bring an end to its occupation. The UN General Assembly has instructed Israel to end its occupation by this coming September 19th.
Yes, well, of course, that's what the International Court of Justice said in the advisory opinion. And now the UN is going to be holding this conference later in June about precisely on the question of Israel's occupation and what states are required to do. It seems like France in particular has backed away from its commitment that it was going to recognize the Palestinian state at this conference. So I'm not sure whether we should hold our breath. But one doesn't expect Israel to comply with international law or the General Assembly. And it has its persistent backer in the Security Council. We just recently again saw the US as the only state opposing a ceasefire and an end to the war on Gaza, the genocide on Gaza. The US stands alone now in backing Israel, but as long as it does, and with whether implicit or overt support of other Western states, Israeli impunity will continue. It is up to civil society to keep the pressure on its politicians, to work as many lawyers and advocates have been doing in every possible way. To hold individuals to account when they can. Now, all states could issue arrest warrants on their own for principles, Israeli principles, and principles of other countries.